This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. On this President's Day, we're going to dig into presidential history and debunk some myths about the Founding Fathers' own religious beliefs and their ideas for religion's role in the new nation they were creating. In his book, Founding Faith, Providence, Politics, and the Birth of Religious Freedom in America, our guest Stephen Waldman writes that the Founding Faith wasn't Christianity or secularism. It was religious liberty, a revolutionary formula for promoting faith by leaving it alone. Waldman is the founder and editor-in-chief of BeliefNet, a website about religion and spirituality. It's not affiliated with any religion or movement. Terry spoke with Waldman last year. He said he hoped his research into the United States' early history with faith would help clear up some of the arguments in the culture wars.
One of the conclusions that I had in going through this process is that the culture wars, the fights between activists on both sides of this have really distorted what really happened, how we ended up with religious freedom and the religious beliefs of the Founding Fathers. Everyone cherry picks quotes from Founding Fathers to prove their point of view. And after a while, you read these things and you feel like there's almost a custody battle over the Founding Fathers. They're just being used by different camps to prove whatever they want. And the reality of what actually happened gets distorted.
In your book, Founding Faith, among other things, you debunk myths about religion and the early development of America. So let's start with one of those myths that you debunk. You say America was settled as a bastion for religious freedom. It wasn't?
It was not settled as a bastion for religious freedom. Most of the people who came here came because they wanted to establish a particular denomination, a particular approach to religion, often at the expense of other denominations. And one point that is often lost in this is that it was usually Protestant denominations, not Christian, but Protestant specifically, often as a way of fighting the spread of Catholicism.
So most of the colonies were interested in religious freedom for their religion, for the religion that settled the state, but not for anybody else's religion.
Right. And in fact, one of the things that Americans don't realize is that in the first 150 years, we had really horrible persecution as each colony experimented with having a particular religion in charge. And so in Massachusetts, there was a terrible persecution of Quakers, to the point of hanging four different Quakers simply for the crime of being a Quaker. In Virginia, there was horrible persecution against Baptists. And you go colony by colony, and in each case, there was sort of an experiment in having a majority or dominant faith running the state. And in each case, the experiment failed.
Yeah, let me quote something that you quote in the book, and this is from a 1703 book called New England Judged by the Spirit of the Lord. It was written by an English Quaker named George Bishop, and he's talking about some of the persecution of Quakers. This is about Alice Ambrose, Mary Tompkins, and Ann Coleman, who had taken to preaching their gospel at the river. They were arrested and, quote, stripped naked from the middle upward and tied to a cart, after a while cruelly whipped, whilst the priest stood, looked on, and laughed at it. Does that sound like a pretty typical way that religious minorities were treated in the colonies?
Well, it was probably an extreme version, but the persecution of the Quakers was pervasive in Massachusetts, and you can sense the almost the sadism involved in some of the punishments. I think that really every American who's interested in religious freedom ought to know the stories of these Quakers and women like Mary Dyer, who was a Boston woman who had a similar punishment made to her, again, for the crime of being a Quaker. She was banished. She came back because she believed in the right to express her religious beliefs. She was brought up to the scaffold with two other Quakers to be executed. She watched as her friend's neck snapped, and then they gave her a reprieve. The goal all along was to force her to watch her friends being executed. They gave her a second chance. She came back again because of her conviction that she ought to have the right to practice her faith. And this time she was executed on the Boston Commons from an oak tree there.
So most of the colonies were created by people who wanted to create a safe haven for their particular form of Protestantism. Although Maryland was created as a haven for Catholics and Pennsylvania as a haven for Quakers and other minorities. But one thing that held most of the colonies together is that they all didn't want Jews.
Yes, at least they could agree on that. And most of them didn't want Catholics, because even in the case of Maryland, which did start off as a haven for Catholics, quickly got overthrown and became hostile to Catholics also. But yeah, when they talked about toleration, as the word went back then, it really usually referred to toleration of different Protestant sects. And Jews and Catholics and certainly atheists were simply not part of the equation. What that meant was they could not hold office, they could not vote, and other rights were denied.
The British Anglican Church was seen as too close to the Catholic Church, even though Henry VIII had broken away from the Catholic Church. And during the colonial period, the Pope was sometimes called the Antichrist. The Catholic Church was called the whore. It's interesting because you see that same language in some contemporary evangelical literature, like the Born Again series. Isn't the Pope the Antichrist in that series?
Yes, and it's really hard to kind of get your head around this, but it's back then, we think obviously of Catholics as a major Christian denomination. A quarter of our population are Catholic. But back then, Catholics were not just seen as a different Christian denomination. In a lot of cases, they were seen as the enemy and in many cases the reason that people left Europe. This obviously was changing, and by the 1770s, it was a very different mix. Catholic role started to really change. But for a long time, Catholics were viewed as enemies of freedom.
Now, another myth you tried to debunk in your book, Founding Faith, is that the United States was founded as a Christian nation.
Well, of course, you hear a lot from religious conservatives now that America was founded as a Christian nation. And it's just not true. It is true that America was settled in the very early days by Christians wanting to establish it as a Christian land. But by the time you got to the founding of the United States of America, the new nation, the founders had looked at what had happened in the previous 150 years and turned away and turned towards a different model. So they very explicitly and intentionally created a constitution that was not Christian. And as recently as, you know, 5-10 years before that, there was still very overtly Christian language in documents, for instance, that the Continental Congress had produced. So the lack of Christian rhetoric in the Constitution was very notable and was criticized by some people at the time.
So what is some of the religious language that shows up in a lot of documents of the time that is not, intentionally not, in the Constitution?
Well, if you look at the Articles of Confederation, it said that the document hath pleased the great governor of the world. There were numerous proclamations from the Continental Congress that used language referring to the supreme judge, the ruler of the universe. The state constitutions often referred to Christianity as the true religion. And even the Declaration of Independence, of course, says that our rights are endowed by our Creator. Even that wasn't in the Constitution. It was stripped bare and has literally no religious rhetoric in it at all.
So what does that say to you?
It says it was a conscious, radical, not accidental step that the framers of the Constitution took in order to take a different path than what they had had before. Specifically, that the national government should not be thought of as a Christian government. Now, one of the things I do talk about in the book is that the Constitution was also a pact that said, while the national government shouldn't be a Christian government, the state governments could be. So it was a bit more of a mix on this question of whether we were a Christian nation than you might think.
So the Establishment Clause, which established a separation between church and state, didn't apply to the states. It only applied to the federal government. So what are some of the institutions that were left out of the Establishment Clause?
Well, of course, pretty much everything. You know, schools, local city halls. Most of what happened in America at that time was regulated by the colonies and the states, not by the federal government. And this was a big disappointment to James Madison, actually, when he was promoting what became the First Amendment. He wanted it to apply to the states, but he lost. This is something that's often forgotten, that Madison did not get his way on that, and that the compromise he had to pull together in order to rustle up the votes to pass the First Amendment was that this would ban there being a national religion in the national government, but very much allow the states to do what they wanted. And so at the point of the Constitution, when it passed, there were states that still banned Catholics from office, banned Jews from office, made blasphemy a crime, all sorts of religious penalties. All of that the Constitution let stand.
So the Establishment Clause separating church and state didn't apply to the states until after the Civil War, when the 14th Amendment was written, which said...
The 14th Amendment applied the basic rights of the Constitution and Bill of Rights to the states. So those who are angry that the Constitution has not allowed for enough religion in the public square, in a way, should shake their fist not only at the ACLU or Thomas Jefferson, but also at Lincoln and General Grant, because it was really the Civil War and the passage of the 14th Amendment that reorganized the basic pact on religious freedom and said that the same spirit of freedom that was applied just in a limited sense to the federal government by the founders should now be applied to the states as well.
So as you point out, the ratification of the Constitution was a very political process. There was a lot of disagreement every step of the way. And, for example, the Establishment Clause is constantly being debated. You know, how does that apply to prayer in the schools and creches and public squares? What guides your interpretation of the Establishment Clause?
Well, first, that it was a very political process. And we tend to almost imagine that it went straight from James Madison's quill pen right over to the National Archives. And, of course, that's not what happened. It was a proposal, and then it was a Senate committee and a House committee and a conference committee. And, you know, much of the horse trading that you see now on a piece of legislation happened then. That's how the First Amendment was born. And by design, some of it was kicked down the road to be dealt with by the rest of us. You almost want to kind of reach back and you know, slap Madison in the face gently because he was a very frail little man. But you want to say there's so much ambiguity here. Why couldn't you have made this clearer to help us out so we wouldn't have to have 200 years of lawsuits and court cases to battle this out? And I think the reality is that some of the ambiguity was intentional because that was the way they could get it through in the first place. Madison was the one who came up with kind of the most holistic and integrated philosophy of religious freedom. It borrowed from the Enlightenment thinkers who were worried about religion messing up government, but it also borrowed from the evangelical Christians of that day, the Baptists, who Madison was very close to, and their view was different. Their view was that separation of church and state was crucially important in order to promote religion. We have this notion right now that, you know, you have conservatives who say that we need to promote religion and therefore we should have less separation of church and state. And you have some people who are advocating for more separation as a way of reducing the role of religion. Madison's view and the view of the evangelicals at that moment was really different. They wanted to promote religion. They thought having religion flourish was very important to the birth of this republic. They just thought that the best way for religion to flourish was for government to get out of the way. And that was a very different – it's a very different perspective than you hear now.
Another myth you try to debunk, the founding fathers wanted religious freedom because they were devout Christians. They weren't?
Well, first of all, there's almost no such thing as the founding fathers when it comes to religious freedom, or at least thinking of them as a unitary block. The founding fathers often disagreed with each other over how to deal with this. Some of them were Orthodox Christians. Some of them weren't. But the ones that we tend to focus on as the most important for religious freedom, meaning George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Ben Franklin, none of them were Orthodox Christians in the sense that we mean it now. For instance, most of those five had very serious problems and criticisms of church hierarchy and priests. Jefferson and Franklin had turned away from the Bible as a literal document. They believed that Jesus was a great teacher, but they didn't think that Jesus was divine, and had really angry, almost vicious things to say about the church hierarchy. And in Jefferson's case, he went after everyone from Apostle Paul to Calvin to the doctrine of the Trinity, which he called the abracadabra of mountebanks. And he thought the whole Bible was an exercise in covering up the diamonds, which were Jesus's moral teachings, with what he called the dung that was everything else.
Well, Jefferson tried to write a Bible as he thought Jesus would have wanted it. What are some of the differences between the Bible that Jefferson was rewriting and the Bible as we know it?
This is really an amazing scene. To picture Thomas Jefferson, he actually started on this while he was president. He's sitting there in the presidential mansion after the work is done for the day, and he has his Bible in front of him, and he's cutting out the parts of the Bible that he likes and pasting it into a new volume. And then he repeated the process later on in 1899 when he was in retirement. And basically, he cut out the miracles. He cut out any sign that Jesus was divine. He essentially cut out the Christmas story and the Easter story. In Jefferson's Bible, the rock is moved in front of Jesus' tomb and never moves again. That's where his Bible ends. And it's really remarkable. I mean, you look at this and think, wow, this guy could never get elected now. Jefferson just wouldn't have been able to pass political scrutiny given the things he said about religion and Christianity.
I guess you could say he certainly didn't have a fundamentalist point of view where the New Testament is the literal word of God. He was rearranging it, cutting and pasting it.
He was cutting and pasting it, and his goal, he said, was to rescue the character of Jesus. This is something that's often lost, and sometimes people look at Jefferson and think, oh, he was anti-religion and anti-God, and he was a secular guy. That's not true either. He had real problems with the Bible and with church. But in a way, he was actually a very religious or spiritual person. He was doing this whole exercise of editing the Bible because he felt that Christianity and Jesus' teaching were the most sublime and true in history and that they had been corrupted.
Now, you write that when George Washington was a general during the Revolutionary War, that he purged the anti-Catholic bias from the military, and that was kind of a military necessity. Why was it a military necessity, and how did he end the anti-Catholic bias within the troops?
George Washington is really a quite an important figure in terms of the history of religious tolerance in America, not so much for what he did as president, but for what he did as the leader of the Continental Army. And what was happening was it was kind of a regular tradition once a year to burn effigies of the Pope on Guy Fawkes Day. And this was happening in 1774 and 1775 as it usually did. And Washington was just appalled by this. He said, this is monstrous. He didn't like it as a personal matter, but there was something else, which is that he was trying to neutralize and win over the French Canadians to the north who were Catholic. And they were in a very important effort to try to win France as an ally to the American cause, which was also – France was Catholic at the time. He said, this is not only wrong, it's stupid. We're going to – I don't think he used the word stupid, but he probably said ill-advised and monstrous. But he thought it was very unproductive, and he banned the practice. And he also got the Continental Congress to switch on this as well. Up until that point, Congress had been passing sort of anti-Catholic resolutions, and then they sort of got with the program and came to realize that if they were going to try to court France as an ally, they needed to start reaching out to Catholics and start talking about religious tolerance as a virtue and as a great asset in American life.
Well, Stephen Waldman, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stephen Waldman is the author of the book Founding Faith, Providence, Politics, and the Birth of Religious Freedom in America. He's also the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the faith and spirituality website BeliefNet. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.